So this back in 2016, there was a protest at a school in Pretoria in South Africa, former white school, in which particularly the star of this was a black pupil called Zuleika Patel, who argued that school rules were racist because they required her to have neat hair. And this didn't count as neat hair. And this provoked a big debate in South Africa. The debate went roughly like this. So on the one side, there were people saying, like the school saying, look, it's reasonable for school to have rules about neatness. The same rules apply to everyone. They're not racist, they apply to everyone. There's no intent for them to be racist. They just specify how hair should look because it's a school. And well, we just have, you know, I mean, all schools have rules about appearances, or at least all private schools, or a lot of them. And it never even really occurred to anybody. It's been like that for ages. One of the worst arguments that you hear justifying almost any status quo. But there was a challenge from the people making the protest, which was that the rule placed a bigger burden on black students because of the nature of black hair. It requires completely different treatment. Or specialized hairdressers in the first instance. And secondly, because the notion of neat is itself culturally specific. So why should neat be straight or in pigtails or something like that? It's not the same as saying that neatness itself is unreasonable. It was saying, look, why this way of having your hair is a culturally specific one. And the view was, look, the rule doesn't have to intend to be racist to be racist. That's not what racism is. And indeed ignorance, so it never even occurred to us, itself could amount to a kind of racism. People talk about willful ignorance. So was lockdown racist? I'm going to start by setting up what I call the hair test for racism. I am going to argue that lockdown was externally imposed on Africa, which is part of one of the conditions of the hair test, that it placed a disproportionate burden on Africa. I'm going to argue that you can infer from I'm going to say something about what it means for race for something to be bad for Africa. And I am going to conclude that lockdown was racist. So what was lockdown? What do I mean by lockdown? Broadly speaking, regulations reversing the normal burden of reasons for leaving home. I am not going to give a necessary and sufficient conditions type definition because I don't think that's the right way to go. This is a family resemblance term. Like, there are a lot of different varieties in what was actually done, yet they were called by roughly the same thing. They were seen as being roughly the same thing, largely because they shared a purpose, which is the purpose of suppression. And that's something I'm going to talk about further as well. They shared a mechanism which was for achieving suppression, which was to reduce social contact outside the home. The idea was to reduce it by 75% or more. They were promoted by powerful nations, most of the EU, China, large chunks of America, over the American political institution. They were advocated globally by the World Health Organization and others. There wasn't any modeling of their effects on anything other than COVID. So I'm treating lockdown as a historical episode, hence was. I'm particularly focused on the first period of 2020. I'm not treating it as a platonic concept. You can do that if you want. I just don't think that's the correct way to approach this. So let me set up this hair test. There's two traditions I'm going to say in very crudely as regards race and racism. The liberal tradition, this is Lawrence Blum, who is a philosopher of race based in South Africa, is American origin, I believe, which says that race originated in Europe as a concept to justify colonial expansion. The idea is that there are biologically different subtypes or subspecies of human. It is a, on the liberal view, defunct scientific concept. It was backed by science, which is now defunct. There are famous attacks on race by 20th century scientists like Lewontin and Stephen Jay Gould. It is, if it's got any biological basis, it is a rough approximation to something like clades or adaptations to local environments, not subspecies, very superficial, and there's been continued admixture. So, you know, the idea is that there is really very little biological significance, or perhaps none. And primarily, these are social constructs. That's the view. To that extent, the idea is that racial identities are acceptable and can be celebrated, but not if they are seen as being very, very strong biological categories. In some sense, that is, you know, it's part of the struggle of this tradition to make that this lot clear. It's not ethnicity on this view. Ethnicity requires shared language and culture, something like that. You can have a number of different ethnicities within a race, within a racial grouping. It's also, I should add, something that people tend to think should not really be externally imposed, but should be a matter of self-determination. And it should be applied on this view, on this guy's view, to serious and what did he say? Serious and deliberate moral wrongs. And he identifies inferiorization and antipathy, which means bigotry. And inferiorization means identifying biological characteristics and so forth, which you regard as inferior and like, or lower IQ or something, and then hatred on that basis, and shouldn't be applied to what he calls lesser racial ills and infractions. It was in the early 2000s that he was saying this, and this view has fallen out of favor everywhere, including in South Africa, or in many places, but including in South Africa and in Africa more generally, I think, but certainly I know about the South African context. So there are a number of challenges. There's the notion of institutional racism, which undermines the idea that you need intent. And the idea here is that there's a stacked deck in some institutions against some racial groups. There's this sort of critical race theory, which is, I'm not going to attempt to summarize, but one of the features is that it puts experience at the center. And the idea is that, you know, in line with some feminist thinking, that just abstract reasoning about things that concern people greatly is just, well, part of the problem in a way. There's a rejection of colorblindness, a rejection of this idea that you can just talk about racial groupings instead of the sort of thicker concept of race, perhaps, of specific races, you know, it mattering what the races are. To the notion, it's not like some contentless notion, something like that. And the idea is that colorblindness fails to recognize problems of, for example, Black people, and instead problematizes Blackness. That's the idea there. There's then going up to the more radical, Julius Malema, who's the head of the Economic Freedom Fighters in South Africa, who's this guy, extremely smart and for me quite a terrifying character, but he is arguing very effectively at the moment that Africa is a country, which is exactly the opposite of what a lot of sort of certainly the white liberal establishment, I mean, would say. So it's moving race much closer to ethnicity, he wants white people out of Africa, because it's a country of Africans, this kind of thing. And then even more, I mean, this guy's so extreme that he's been expelled from the party this guy runs for being too extreme. So this guy says that Black people can't be racist, specifically famous for saying that, among other things, because it's a bit like Catherine McKinnon's view that women can't consent to sex because of power structures in society. So the idea is that, you know, there are power structures which mean that racism is only makes sense within a where the powerful people are being racist, something like that. So I want to position myself somewhere between these. These are not generally speaking things I want to endorse, and I'm not going to argue against them, but I want to, broadly speaking, have a test for racism which covers a fairly large central chunk of views about race and doesn't commit me too much. And if you know anything about the history of South Africa under apartheid, you'll know I've got a picture of a pencil there. So I'm going to say that a rule of is racist if it meets these conditions, but not only if it meets these conditions. So if it firstly places a burden on a racial group, which is A, disproportionate, and B, unnecessary, and if, but not only if, the rule is externally imposed. So this is a sufficient condition. There could be other kinds of racism. Disproportionate meaning in relation to the burden on other races. Doesn't count of race as racist on this test if everyone has the same burden. Unnecessary in relation to some obvious overriding goods. So if it's necessary to preserve life, then I'm not going to count it as racist by this test. By burden, I just mean anything welfare related. I'm not going to be specific about what kind of burden. Externally imposed, I want to set aside internal cultural norms. So like, you know, if there's some racial group where there's an internal cultural norm to do something which places a burden, I'm not going to count that as racist, at least not in this sense. Maybe there's some other, you know, somebody wants to articulate some other notion of racism, but not this sense. And I'm going in that vein to allow other kinds of racism. So I'm not interested in closing the doors on what counts as racist. I just want a broad notion that will, I want a test which, in virtue of which the hair case satisfied the criteria for being racist, was racist, and that the rules were racist, which we can then apply to other rules, being those involved in lockdown. Hello. Sorry. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. and this is incompatible with parts of the liberal tradition, specifically with the intent requirement, because I don't think many people, I think times have just changed. People no longer think that you have to have intent, or a rule has to be intentionally racist or discriminatory in order to be racist. I don't think, I could argue that, but I think that in any case, that's the test. The test has that outcome. On the other hand, it is incompatible with extreme views. For example, black people can be racist on this because these rules could be set up by anybody, regardless of their race. So, and obviously, I'm looking for a test for racism of rules, because racism of rules is what I'm looking to assess when assessing lockdowns. So I'm going to go through and just show that these conditions are met by lockdown. By talking specifically about Africa, partly because it's the place I know most about in this connection, not that I know particularly much about it, partly just because I think it deserves more airtime. Second largest continent, second most populous continent. So these are two reports by Imperial College London. This one has had a huge amount of attention. Report 9, they modeled deaths in the UK and America, said there were going to be tons of them. This less widely discussed report 12, they effectively extended, it wasn't the same model, but they effectively extended the exercise for the rest of the world with a particular view to looking at lower income countries, but they stratified by low income, low middle income, high middle income, higher income countries. And this is a blog, a very famous blog post by a guy named Thomas Puccio or something. I can't remember his name now, or read it. Both of which are things that deteriorate with age. So basically the idea was that if you do nothing, you get this outcome, terrible result. If you try and kind of mitigate, you still get a pretty bad result. And if you take drastic action, you're gonna get this. The point of that, showing that graph, is that these things, these reports were very influential, and I'm going to try and say something about why. So they got out into the popular domain. That blog post was translated into 30 languages and read 40 million times. So I'm going to look particularly at those papers and suggest that the science, quote unquote, said lockdown now, even though the word lockdown isn't used in either of those reports. So they did A number of things, those reports. Four things. Firstly, they put in place this idea that regulations to reduce social contact are the primary means to reduce COVID. So you've got a universe of policy options. And they said, okay, one dimension, regulations to reduce social contact. So they've got a universe, got it into one dimension. Then they say there's a binary distinction depending on your intention, what you're intending to do, between two strategies, suppressing the spread of COVID and mitigating it. And then they said, they showed with their modeling that suppression is the only way to avoid unacceptably high mortality. You basically got this very sharply diverging R number below one. I should have said suppression means getting the reproductive number below one so that the pandemic starts to recede, as opposed to mitigation, which means allowing it to grow, but carefully and controlling it. And these were all argued for in report 9. These were confirmed in report 12, but report 12 specifically said that these apply globally. I have pulled out specific passages that support each of these claims. I'm not going to do that and read them out to you, but I've got them in a paper. There are additional features that lead to this conclusion that these reports, which on the face of it, don't use the word lockdown, nonetheless shaped this strategy. The first is that the word suppression is used ambiguously there. So as I said, it's policies intended to suppress, so intended to reduce social contact or to achieve suppression. And these intentions were then modeled as an actual reduction of 75%. Of course, it's not the same thing. And the result of that was policies were understood homogeneously, which I think contributed to the, you know, this term lockdown being used so indiscriminately across such a wide range of different measures, because they shared a type through a shared goal. But of course, these strategies could play out quite differently, and the actual policies could play out quite differently in a number of ways. The same regulation put in place in Uganda might have a totally different effect from the same regulation in Germany. It might have a much lesser effect than a mere suggestion in Sweden. And there's good evidence for this kinds of things. Compliance differs. And of course, the strategies actually involved, the policies actually involved were quite different as well. Secondly, time pressure. They emphasized how urgent this all was. It's emphasized again and again in the reports. Like they consider the different strategies, and then within the suppression strategy, they stratify by how soon you need to act in order to achieve suppression. And basically, it's like you've already waited too long by putting this report on your desk for the weekend from Friday to Monday. I mean, it's that kind of. And there's just no chance for poor countries to check that. None. There's just no. I mean, these. In fact, people don't know this, but the actual. I mean, even within epidemiology, what these guys at Imperial College London do is a speciality. Most epidemiologists don't have a clue about this stuff either. Most epidemiology is retrospective. It's about causal analysis, whatever, causal inference or description of patterns, primarily not descriptive, primarily not based on using agent-based modeling or anything like that. So it was a very specialized technical exercise, and the expertise, there's no chance to get that expertise together, certainly in low-income settings. And it bore the authority of the World Health Organization. It's on the reports. It's on the slide I put up previously. Who put out these general global guidelines with no specifics. I mean, that was how I got into it, actually. I was looking for the Africa-specific guidelines, because I was thinking, well, this is always not going to be possible here. There just weren't any. Just one set of guidelines, keep 2 meters distance. And I was thinking, how is that going to work? Basically, a constellation of factors said you got a lockdown. So the science, which is what I talked about, it was endorsed by the World Health Organization. China endorsed it, appeared to have done it successfully. And China is a major investor in Africa. Europe endorsed it, major source of aid. The rest of the world were mostly doing it. I think 100% of the world had a higher than 65% measure on the Oxford Stringency Index by April or so. The liberal press was hounding those countries that didn't, like Sweden. And Sweden has Scandinavia is really good on epidemiology. Sweden is really good on epidemiology. And they were getting hounded. So what are you going to do if you're Chad or something? The memory of AIDS denialism remains strong. And then people underestimate the extent to which local interests played a role. I mean, there was considerable corruption as a consequence of the lockdown measures in South Africa. I mean, it's known. It's a matter of public inquiry. They were banning things that didn't need to be banned, like cigarettes. The person who was running the regulations is known to get money. I mean, there are pictures of her with cigarette smugglers. The EFF didn't oppose this. They also received funding from cigarette smugglers. You know, food deliveries just staying at provincial governors' houses. I mean, I don't think the extent to which corruption can vitiate these kind of regulations is understood in a global context. In the context, it's certainly not, you know, in these reports that I was talking about, nothing like that's mentioned. Nothing about the strength of the state, the corruption, anything like that. And of course, local political, if you're a local politician, you might well get some political gain from getting yourself a lockdown. That's a factor as well. So I think together these things amount to a case for external imposition, reasonably understood. African states that didn't, and looking at Africa, obviously, that didn't lock down could expect to be pariahs. That happened to Tanzania, whose leader was portrayed as a lunatic and arguably was, but nobody wants to be seen that way, I suppose. And I already discussed what happened to Sweden. There wasn't consultation, and I was just amazed by this at the time as well. I mean, if there's anything you the public health experts know, it's that you've got to have some degree of consultation or measures won't be accepted or implemented effectively. And there wasn't either of African states or of African scientists or of African populations. These things just came out from, the unfortunately named Imperial College, among others. There was no, as I said, prospect of checking. There wasn't local advice on these matters. There was a choice whether to lock down, but it wasn't really a free or an informed choice. Malawi didn't lock down. They tried to, but the opposition party mounted a challenge, and the court set the lockdown order aside, which I thought was really quite funny at the time. But generally, there wasn't much of a choice. And I think this suffices in this context for external imposition. I'm not going to talk masses about the World Health Organization, but I do think they have some significant introspection to do on this. Lockdown placed a disproportionate burden on Africa. I'm going to talk about age, competing threats to life, poverty, effectiveness, suppression as a goal, and suppression as a strategy. Age. Does anybody know the median age of either Europe or Africa? I just love these numbers. You want to guess? Europe? Okay. Has anybody read my abstract? 19.7. So half the population in Africa is teenage or younger. So I think the numbers, I was brought up to argue, and then I just realized actually stick some numbers up. So the median age in Europe is 42 and a half. It's 19.7 in Africa. COVID deaths in the UK, this is a freedom of information request was put in, interestingly, is 83 as of January 2021. Life expectancy in Europe, this is of COVID deaths. So half the people dying of COVID are 83 or older, I suppose, and half are that age or younger. Life expectancy at birth in Europe is 80, as is the mean of COVID deaths, incidentally. Life expectancy in Africa at birth is 64. Interestingly, it's much lower for men, considerably lower for men, 60 versus 66. And the age stratified case fatality or infection fatality rates in Africa are like way skewed towards men, like 75% to 25%. So that is itself interesting. And then deaths in 2020 due to COVID is 1.8 million. And this is a familiar figure from UNICEF, 5 million people. I think kids, sorry, under five died in 2020, 5.2 million in 2019. So the point I'm just trying to make here is that the threat that COVID poses in a place depends on context in various ways, and age is one of them. There are other threats to life. I'll talk about that in a moment. But also, I mean, COVID, it was known from very early on that COVID is not a public health threat of any major kind in people at that age of, you know, 19.7 or younger. In fact, you don't see any excess mortality in the last two years, except from COVID, until you get above the age of 25. So it's just on the face of it, there's going to be a different threat posed in absolute terms. And this point here is just to do with the fact that these people are dying of, as I'll say, largely infectious diseases, the largest number of them in Africa, under the age of five, and it's an annual thing. I'll talk more about that in a minute. So there are, by the same token, competing threats to life. So these are leading causes of death in low-income countries. These green ones are infectious diseases. The blue ones are non-communicable diseases. That one is injury, so that's just road injuries. So you can see that, and cirrhosis of the liver is down here, that's presumably alcohol-related. But you can see that neonatal conditions, lower respiratory infections, these are obviously specifically important for children. Diarrhea is specifically important for children. Well, that's also, I mean, that's pregnancies as well. Malaria is specifically important for children. Then, the others, these are more for older people. Road injury is probably particularly important for young people, teenagers, whatever. Anyway, the point is there are competing things to worry about. That's the main point I want to make here. Compared to a high-income country where, you know, obviously something's got to kill you at the end of the day, but there's really only one infectious disease here, and that is lower respiratory infections, so pneumonia, presumably arising from flu in older people. Lower respiratory infections are the leading cause of death among infants in Africa. Which is just interesting because what you need for this is ventilators, among other things. It's very much similar things to what you need to deal with COVID. So the point being, if you're gonna put that kind of resource in, then you'd think that you might look at some of these first. Poverty, obviously is significant in Africa. 90% of the workforce is in the informal economy. 40% of sub-Saharan Africa is in extreme poverty, and that's going up because of COVID, because of the lockdowns. So in 2019, it was 40% on less than 190 per day. That's the extreme poverty line. Many more than that below upper bound poverty line. And the state won't provide support. You're not going to get a welfare state pop into existence overnight, providing furlough and grants or anything like that. That's just not going to happen. If it were, then you wouldn't have so many people in extreme poverty in the first place. Protecting the healthcare system, I mean, those reports and the whole strategy of certainly the UK and much of the developed world was about protecting the healthcare system. You know, that's not, and even in those reports, they were talking about that in the context of low-income countries. And I was reading them again on the train. It's just so strange. It's like, you know, if you don't have any ventilators in a country, like if there are literally no ventilators, then what does that even mean, protecting the healthcare system? You know, if the healthcare available to people is either 4 days walk away or you go to a clinic and whatever you've got, the only thing they can give you is paracetamol. And what does that even mean? So it's a very odd goal, I think, in that context. And especially also if it disrupts effective public health measures that are in place. So there are good public health measures in many parts of Africa to deal with things like malaria and TB and so forth, vaccination. But the impact of the lockdowns was to close these things down significantly, measurably. Doing it in this context is obviously going to have a very significant negative effect, a really significant negative effect. And closing schools is obviously going to have a significant effect. Education is a major predictor of, in women, of the number of children that they're going to have, which is in turn a major predictor of regional poverty. If the economic growth doesn't match the growth of fertility, doesn't match the growth in fertility and population. And that is the case at the moment in Africa, that they're not keeping up. Basically, recession in Africa means hunger and death and disease. It's this, you know, I think Anne Case made this point early on that during recessions, mortality is actually lower. And then Peter Singer, who was in the debate with her, said, yeah, only in America, or only in high-income countries. That is emphatically not true in Africa. It's not about house prices and savings and retirement funds. You know, it's about having food. And you can see this. This was the impact of the heart. I realized missed a slide here where I should have told you about how the lockdown worked out in South Africa. It's one of the only countries that released its lockdown over time as the waves got worse. And they did that because they locked down super early, super hard, and couldn't sustain it. So very, very stringent lockdowns for 5 weeks, and then still very stringent lockdowns for another 5 weeks, just marginally. You know, you could go out to exercise during a three-hour window, for example. And then, you know, these had no observable effect at all on the growth of the pandemic, which continued to grow very slowly and then came down again after the lockdowns had been lifted. But you can see the effect on the GDP, which was enormous, and it's now gone up again to roughly the point it was in 2017. So there's no question that hard lockdowns have a major impact on African economies. Also, they don't work in that context. You can see this just on principle. I mean, lockdown was modeled as a 75% reduction in social contact. You're not going to, outside the home, you're not going to achieve that in this kind of conditions, because people need to leave regularly. So about half of Africa lives rurally, about half in cities, and of the people in cities, about half live in slums. Something about a billion to 1.6 billion globally. So you're going to have to leave your home because of overheating. It gets hot in these things in the day, because, you know, whatever, your uncle's trying to rape you, or whatever, horrible. You know, people have to leave just for work, for getting water, for getting food, for getting whatever grants the government might be offering, to wash. There's no obviously quite water in many of these contexts. You're not going to be able to stay home. And even if you did, I'm not clear, and I'm not clear to what extent they got this in their modeling, but what is the effect of staying home if there's 10 or 15 people in a shack? Are you even going to reduce social contact by doing that? The early on, this cruise ship, the Princess Diamond, there was a, you know, it was concluded about that the spread of COVID was faster than if they had just been allowed to disembark, right? Because when they were being held in quarantine, it spread very quickly around the ship. And there's some evidence that I've seen some reports that I think in Zimbabwe, that lockdown actually seemed to have sped things up, but I don't know how credible that is. But it's certainly the case that a lot of people live in single room dwellings in Africa. And of course, the enforcement can be brutal or non-existent in the rural areas. So in the rural areas, nobody's going to do it. And police aren't going to rock up once a day at some village that's 30 kilometers down a bumpy track. It's just not going to happen. In Uganda and South Africa, and I remember one time, and there was a point early on where the COVID had killed three reported deaths from COVID and 11 reported deaths from police enforcing lockdown regulations. You know, obviously that didn't last, but it's brutal. you know, fundamentally, if you can't live without leaving your home, you're going to leave your home. Suppression is an inappropriate goal, even regardless of whether lockdowns are effective in this context, because, as I said, preserving the health system is not a great goal. But secondly, there isn't a plan B, and a failed lockdown is terrible. It's a terrible thing. It's the worst of both worlds. And they were correct, I think. The model is that missing lockdown results in continued growth. The upshot of that, though, is that if you do a bunch of things and then you just about miss lockdown, you're in a horrible position. You've got to either continue putting in more and more stringent measures, try to achieve suppression, trying to chase that R number below one, or you've got to relax things contrary to your original strategy. And I mean, these are not especially clear, but you know, if this is the line you've got to reach to get a benefit from lockdown, and this is what happens, then and your intervention doesn't work because it gets more serious, you're getting diminishing returns and you're just never going to reach it. This is a context like New Zealand where it can work. You get there quickly enough, I'm going to have to change this graphic. It's not very clear. So anyway, Africa never had a prospect of suppression. It never actually did lockdown in any case. I think if you want to know what the mitigation strategy would look like in Africa, you just got to look at the data. So did it have a disproportionate negative effect? Well, the benefit, well, did it have a benefit? Well, not really. You can't achieve that kind of reduction in social contact. You won't get compliance. Median age is very young, so the risk posed by COVID is less in the first place. And the risk relative to other threats is lower too. The impact on livelihoods on the cost side, the burden side is higher. Impact on health is higher. Impact on health services is higher. The states are unable to provide relief in the enforcement is brutal. So yes, it did have a disproportionate negative effect. You know. From place to race, I'm going to argue that lockdown burdened Black people, firstly by burdening Africa, second within Africa, thirdly outside Africa. And talk briefly about a fallacy that gets pulled out in this context. So firstly, lockdown burdened Black people by burdening Africa. So Africa has a population of 1.3 billion approximately. It's the second largest continent after Asia, which has 4.5 billion. A large proportion are of color, obviously, and a large proportion specifically are Black, which is where I'm focusing. I think that if something negative, and maybe this is obvious, but a lot of this is obvious, but then nobody said it, so I'm gonna say it. If something negatively affects Africa in virtue of negatively affecting many people in Africa, then I submit it negatively affects Black people. I'm gonna take that as an assumption effectively. I think it works for many interpretations of many, for the logicians in the room. It doesn't imply that there are no ethnic differences in Africa. It doesn't imply there are no persons of color outside Africa. It doesn't imply that there are no Black people outside Africa, that other racial groupings don't matter, and or that other racial groupings are not discriminated against. It does not imply that something negative for many people in Africa is necessarily negative for all Black people. I'm not saying any of those things. I'm simply saying that if something negatively affects Africa in virtue of negatively affecting its inhabitants, then for many, in many of those situations at least, it's going to negatively affect many Black people. Lockdown burdened Black people within Africa. Well, we have some data on this too, that this is the first and second wave during 2020-21. In a suburb near Cape Town. And there was a hard lockdown through this period. And you can see that in the suburb, these arrows, I mean, the hard lockdown finished here, but you would say, you know, there was a moderate effort here. You can see that this mitigation, you know, this is compatible with these mitigation measures and suppression measures working, because you've got a much lower peak here and a much higher peak here. Suburbs, near Cape Town, primarily white inhabitants. Townships near Cape Town, Khayelitsha is one of the largest, I think the fourth largest in the world, actually, slum. You get quite a different picture. About this, in fact, this one seems even slightly higher, this first peak. So, and these are similar areas. I mean, these will be much younger people by and large. But nonetheless, you see that for the same measures, the exact same measures, you're getting what is in effect something like, you remember the focus protection strategy proposed by the Great Barrington Declaration, that you have a focus protection of the wealthy by old, by keeping them safe, and the younger people go out and get the disease and then build up a herd immunity. I mean, something like that is the effect of the, univocal measure of locking down, where you have very different living conditions, because the people in the slums don't get a benefit, a significant benefit anyway, whereas the people in the suburbs get a much greater benefit. And in this context, that translates racially. So you've got what is, in effect, focus protection. There are measures in the face of it. So I would suggest that if they're burdened black people, at least in some places within Africa, more than white people, virtually they're feminine being wealthy. Outside Africa, you see a similar effect. There are a bunch of studies showing that quote-unquote black Asian minority ethnic groups, a term I don't like, I'll explain why I'm here. Particularly in high-income countries, where these tend to focus. What I've said, everything I've said does apply, and I'm not going to show this, but I'm just going to say it, but it does apply to poorer groups in low middle income countries, high middle income countries, and high income countries. You do get a lower benefit of lockdown, lower effectiveness of lockdown in those contexts, because people are less likely to be able to work from home. They're more likely to be in larger family or smaller dwellings, more people in a dwelling, more likely to have to leave the home for one or another reason. This is, I think, fairly well known. And in fact, the higher prevalence of COVID in these groups is itself evidence for that. I also think that this is arguably a racist term when you think about it, because the minorities bit is redundant. It's true that Black and Asian people are minorities in the UK and in the EU and in the USA, but, so there's 47 million African-Americans to 329 million total population in North America, but there's 1.3 billion people in Africa, and that's more than Europe and Northern America put together, North America put together, and including Russia. And then there's 4.5 billion in Asia. So in no sense are Black or Asian people put together a minority. So what's the point of using that term? It's explanatorily redundant. If you're trying to explain the difference in mortalities between these groups, the use of the term minority is not the explanation. The explanation is more likely to be something to do with the race, because minority goes away when you go to other places, but the racial difference doesn't. And if you wanted to be critical about it, you would say that the best explanation is that the use of the term minority conceals something that, quote unquote, we don't want to admit. I was talking to a Nigerian potential doctoral student at UJ the other day, and he was using the term minorities in a different context to talk about Black people. And I said to him, you've got this from reading European literature, Black people are not a minority relative to white people or whatever, which is the context I was using this. So it's in the academic discourse and the press, it's just very common to see minorities used as a shorthand for people who aren't white, which is just obviously pretty odd. So I think race, not relative population, is a relevant stratification. Finally, I want to just say something a bit more related to that. So there is a line of research, and I'm not going to name any names here for a reason I'll say, which is that which says that there's an impact of COVID on poorer people, including on ethnic minorities, quote unquote. And that is taken to infer, from that it is inferred that society is unfair and not that there was something wrong with the interventions. So the inference would be that governments should have been much quicker and tougher, governments like Boris Johnson's, because they would have protected quote unquote ethnic minorities. This is a very bad argument to the extent it's present anywhere. Because there are policy decisions that mediate the distribution of the outcomes of interest, so COVID deaths, because there are policies that influence the extent to which they all fall in one or another population. And they are decisions that we took. So to treat all that as kind of fixed, to treat your health outcomes as fixed, and to ignore this is a really an obvious error. And I think that that kind of research can actually itself be racist. It can hide unfairness. I mean, racist among other things, among inegalitarian and so forth, can actually hide unfairnesses in a situation which, while purporting to highlight those unfairnesses. So that's why I'm not putting any references here. But I don't want to accuse anybody of anything in particular. Finally, and I'm going over time, the conclusion was locked. So I haven't argued that lockdown was necessary. I've done everything else in the hair test, but not that it was necessary. Very briefly, you know, I had this when I was talking about this. I was interviewed about this a lot early on, and people were like, but it's okay as a precaution, surely. Well, no, because there has to be a prospect of those measures being effective. And it was clear from the outset that these things would be differentially effective in different contexts. Public health, it's a public health mantra that one size doesn't fit all. This is epidemiological expertise, not predictive disease modeling. The designing of interventions with context in mind. There was an idea that it was in fact proportionate because the threat was huge. I think I've dispensed with that already because the scale of the threat depends on the context as well. The consequences weren't known, the consequences of COVID. We didn't know what we were dealing with. Well, true to some extent, but we did know about the age thing, and we did definitely know already about living conditions, and the things I've talked about are general properties of these areas. They're not things we discovered since 2020. No, nobody thought really that vaccinations would be rolled out to Africa like as soon as they were developed. I don't think anybody can have really thought that that was the plan for Africa, if they had thought about it. So lockdown was racist, it placed the burden on Black people, it was disproportionate, unnecessary, and externally imposed. Why did it happen? This is my last slide. It's new. This is a quote from a film we made way early on. Stefan Swartling-Peterson, who was at UNICEF, I like what he said. He said that this COVID is new, we're not used to it. And it can affect the people with the power, the middle class. It can affect us in Europe. And I think that's what's different. This time it's about the people in power, the people who communicate, rather than the poor buggers who've always been dying and we're used to them dying. So I think it served the interests by and large of the rich and powerful and at the expense of the rest to a large extent. This is an instance of interest. I think racism is one aspect of this. And I will stop there. Thank you very much.